You're listening to the Garrett Ashley Mullet Show on Anchor FM. I'm Garrett Ashley Mullet, and I want to talk about everything. At that time, Abijah, the son of Jeroboam, fell sick. And Jeroboam said to his wife, "Arise and disguise yourself, that it not be known that you are the wife of Jeroboam, and go to Shiloh. Behold, Ahijah the prophet is there, who said of me that I should be king over this people. Take with you 10 loaves, some cakes, and a jar of honey, and go to him. He will tell you what shall happen to the child." Jeroboam's wife did so. She arose and went to Shiloh, and came to the house of Ahijah. Now Ahijah could not see, for his eyes were dim because of his age. And Yahweh said to Ahijah, "Behold, the wife of Jeroboam is coming to inquire of you concerning her son, for he is sick. Thus and thus shall you say to her." When she came, she pretended to be another woman. But when Ahijah heard the sound of her feet as she came in at the door, he said, "Come in, wife of Jeroboam. Why do you pretend to be another? For I am charged with unbearable news for you. Go, tell Jeroboam, 'Thus says Yahweh, the God of Israel, because I exalted you from among the people, and made you leader over my people Israel, and tore the kingdom away from the house of David, and gave it to you, and yet you have not been like my servant David, who kept my commandments and followed me with all his heart, doing only that which was right in my eyes. But you have done evil above all who were before you, and have gone and made for yourself other gods and metal images, provoking me to anger, and have cast me behind your back. Therefore, behold, I will bring harm upon the house of Jeroboam, and will cut off from Jeroboam every male, both bond and free, in Israel, and will burn up the house of Jeroboam, as a man burns up dung until it is all gone. Anyone belonging to Jeroboam who dies in the city, the dogs shall eat, and anyone who dies in the open country, the birds of the heavens shall eat. For Yahweh has spoken it. Arise, therefore, go to your house. When your feet enter the city, the child shall die, and all Israel shall mourn for him and bury him. For he only of Jeroboam shall come to the grave, because in him there is found something pleasing to Yahweh, the God of Israel, in the house of Jeroboam. Moreover, Yahweh will raise up for himself a king over Israel, who shall cut off the house of Jeroboam today. And henceforth, Yahweh will strike Israel as a reed is shaken in the water, and root up Israel out of this good land that he gave to their fathers, and scatter them beyond the Euphrates, because they have made their Asherim, provoking Yahweh to anger. And he will give Israel up because of the sins of Jeroboam, which he sinned, and made Israel to sin." Then Jeroboam's wife arose and departed, and came to Tirzah. And as she came to the threshold of the house, the child died. And all Israel buried him and mourned for him, according to the word of Yahweh, which he spoke by his servant Ahijah the prophet. Now the rest of the acts of Jeroboam, how he warred and how he reigned, behold, they are written in the book of the Chronicles of the Kings of Israel. And the time that Jeroboam reigned was 22 years. And he slept with his fathers. And Nadab his son reigned in his place. Now Rehoboam, the son of Solomon, reigned in Judah. Rehoboam was 41 years old when he began to reign, and he reigned 17 years in Jerusalem, the city that Yahweh had chosen out of all the tribes of Israel to put his name there. His mother's name was Naamah, the Ammonite, and Judah did what was evil in the sight of Yahweh, and they provoked him to jealousy with their sins that they committed, more than all that their fathers had done. For they also built for themselves high places and pillars and Asherim on every high hill and under every green tree, and there were also male cult prostitutes in the land. They did according to all the abominations of the nations that Yahweh drove out before the people of Israel. In the 5th year of King Rehoboam, Shishak, king of Egypt, came up against Jerusalem. He took away the treasures of the house of Yahweh and the treasures of the king's house. He took away everything. He also took away all the shields of gold that Solomon had made, and King Rehoboam made in their place shields of bronze, and committed them to the hands of the officers of the guard who kept the door of the king's house. And as often as the king went into the house of Yahweh, the guard carried them and brought them back to the guard room. Now the rest of the acts of Rehoboam and all that he did, are they not written in the book of the Chronicles of the Kings of Judah? And there was war between Rehoboam and Jeroboam continually. And Rehoboam slept with his fathers and was buried with his fathers in the city of David. His mother's name was Naamah the Ammonite, and Abijam, his son, reigned in his place. Welcome back to the Garrett Ashley Mullet Show. This is Garrett Ashley Mullet coming to you from Greeley, Colorado for episode 788 of this podcast. Today is Tuesday, January 2nd, 2024, and that makes this the first episode of a new year. So happy new year to you and to those who are near and dear to you. This episode actually, interestingly, before we talk about 1 Kings 14, which is the passage I just read for you in the Old Testament. This episode was not supposed to be the first of 2024. In fact, it wasn't even supposed to be the last one of 2023. But something unexpected happened, and I was out of commission. I did not feel up for much at all, really, honestly. Even now, I'm not 100% recovered, but I feel well enough to podcast. In fact, I think I'll feel better podcasting than I would if I just kept waiting. But I believe what happened is that a coughing fit threw my back out. And it wasn't just the coughing fit. It was 3 weeks of a lot of sitting in my truck. I mean, a lot, compared to what my usual workflow is or what I've developed as a workflow over the last few years of being a systems integrator and being a PLC and HMI programmer. When I work from home, or if I go to the office to work, I get up periodically. I don't like that feeling of my lower body yelling at me, so to speak, saying, "Hey, you've been sitting for too long." And so I have a standing desk at home that I can just push a button and stand at my computer instead of sitting at my computer. And I do that off and on throughout the day. My standing desk gets plenty of exercise, but then that also means that I have better circulation, and it also means that I can walk into the next room and help with laundry, or I can help with cleaning up, or I can go check on what my wife Lauren and our kids are doing. I can mill about. When I go to the office, it's an office with some pretty long hallways, and plus also my truck is parked out in the parking lot. Where else would it be? But I can get up and I can walk out to my truck in the parking lot to take a smoke break throughout the day. I can walk around the office, walk up and down the hallways. And so I will periodically, once an hour or so, I'll get up and I'll go for a walk just to make sure that I've got some good circulation and I'm not sitting for too long. When I'm working on site, however, and I'm working out of my truck, I may get up from my truck sitting in my truck. But for the most part, I've got my computer set up in my pickup, in the passenger seat, on the desk that I have set up for my truck with a 27-inch widescreen monitor that gets lots of compliments, lots of comments, lots of stares. But I have the 27-inch monitor that is mounted on a passenger seat desk. And when I'm ready to do some field programming, I just unhook the bungee straps that connect the monitor to the back of the seat in the passenger seat so that it doesn't swing around while I'm driving. I just unhook those bungee straps and then I slide the monitor boom arm out and I've got a little tray that hooks onto my steering wheel. You've probably seen those. You probably haven't seen my passenger seat desk set up. Most people don't have anything like that, but the people that I've seen who do have this, they were either inspired by me to do the same thing, or they were inspired by somebody who was inspired by me, which is cool. But the problem is you get not just a day here, a couple of days there, you get 3 weeks of intensive sitting in a truck, even with heated seats, which I have, which is really great. Even with heated seats, even with this great setup in my truck, 3 weeks of sitting, plus also having been sick, plus also a coughing fit, it apparently makes the conditions ideal to throw your back out, which is what it seems like I did. I think I had, and probably still have, although it seems like it's getting better, a slipped disc on the right side is where I feel the pain, and I'm told, my friend Luke Bergman tells me, that means it's probably actually an issue with my left side. My left side being weaker, my right side is trying to overcompensate. It's trying to do a greater share of the work, which is poetic in its way, but it's trying to do a greater share of the work and it's overworking. And so the muscles get very, very tight on the right side to try and make up for what the left side is not doing. What does that remind you of? The point being, not to take jabs at our political situation, but the point being, the throwing of my back out meant about a week of just not being at all comfortable. It started with spasms in my right knee, where I would just randomly get a shooting pain there. And then it progressed, or I guess regressed, it got worse before it's now getting better. It got progressively worse to where all of a sudden, even just breathing sometimes during the day was incredibly painful. Or talking, as weird as that may sound, was very painful. Even just the way that I bring my core into how I speak, how I project my voice, that got to be very uncomfortable. And so I thought, you know what? I was planning on podcasting more, but what do I try to keep in mind anytime I'm making plans? What James says in the New Testament epistle by his name, today or tomorrow, that's what you should be saying. Today or tomorrow, if the Lord wills, we'll live and do this or that. Not today or tomorrow, we're going to go to this or that city and live there and work there and trade and make a profit. And how great is our capacity to plan? How great and clever are we? Don't say that. Don't boast. That's evil. When you boast like that, it may seem like that's no big deal. That's just what it is. No, it's evil. Don't boast in your arrogance, because actually it's not just arrogance. It's also ignorance to suppose that you know where you're going to be a year from now. If the Lord wills, you'll live and do this or that, which isn't to say you shouldn't plan. And it's not to say you shouldn't have goals, but it is to say you should always temper your personal goals with humility. And that isn't just an abstract humility. That's a humility relative God, specifically relative the one who made you. And as this podcast is a labor of love, and it's an effort on my part to try and get more disciplined and to help others as well to become more disciplined in how we approach the truth, how we handle the truth, how we think rightly, how we speak rightly. Insofar as this is supposed to be a labor of love towards God and towards my fellow man, I thought, well, if I'm not able to do this well, and I'm actually feeling more irritable, and I'm also feeling just very foggy because the pain, when it's a background noise sort of a pain, it's so distracting and it's so exhausting, it's so tiring. Plus, I'm not sleeping well, and so I'm off kilter in that regard as well. If I'm not going to be able to do this well, I'm not confident in my ability to do it well, maybe I just shouldn't until I'm feeling better, until I've recovered a bit. And I'll focus on trying to recover and get over this back issue, and then I'll get back to podcasting. And so here I am. I am not 100%, but I am more percent than I was for most of the last couple of weeks. I'm supposed to go into the office this morning and do a follow-up with our senior controls programmer slash controls engineer over some projects that I was given the week of Christmas, the week of New Year's. And so I'm going to go in and give an update and see what he thinks about some of what I have in mind as solutions for the programming scope that I was given. But we'll see how much podcasting we can do before I need to leave. I don't need to leave for another hour and some change. So we'll just see, right? We'll just see what can we fit into this morning, January 2nd, 2024, the first podcast of the new year. Well, for starters, let's talk about 1 Kings chapter 14. What we have in this 14th chapter of 1 Kings is the comeuppance, or this is the beginning of the comeuppance that Jeroboam richly deserves. That's the first thing we need to understand as we're looking at the text is the inclination we may have to sympathize, to feel sorry for Jeroboam and his wife. That tendency on our part is out of calibration. If we think this is not fair, it's not fair. Oh, Jeroboam, what was the big deal? He led Israel away from worship of Yahweh alone. He led Israel into idolatry, even more idolatry than what had cost Solomon the kingdom, the whole reason that Jeroboam is king in the first place. What's the big deal? I mean, Solomon didn't have that much happen to him. So why, right? Why does Jeroboam get such a brutal and harsh sentence? Well, in part, I think it behooves us to consider that what judgment there was on Solomon is part of the context that leaves Jeroboam without excuse. Solomon, at least, maybe was oblivious, and he just kind of slipped into it gradually over time. Jeroboam, it appears pretty much right from the jump. As soon as he saw what seemed to him a politically useful direction to take with the creating of two golden calves to keep Israel from going back to Rehoboam, to keep them from going back to the house of David as king over them. As soon as he saw the politically useful thing, that was all he could see, and that was all he cared about. And it didn't stop with the golden calves. You know, what's interesting, comparing Jeroboam with Solomon, is that Solomon starts out with devoted worship of Yahweh. And when God asks him, "What shall I give you?" at the beginning of his reign, Solomon, who is thought to have been between 20 and 25 years of age, says, "Wisdom to lead and to govern and to rule this, your great people." And that answer really pleased God. So God gave Solomon a tremendous amount of wisdom, which Solomon put to good use for a long, long time. And then over time, as Solomon didn't just multiply wives for himself in a general sense, but he multiplied wives from particular nations that God had forbidden Israel from intermarrying with, nations whose beautiful young princesses worshiped other gods, the gods of the nations, as that led Solomon's heart away, and he started trying to please his wives more than he was committed to pleasing God, he found himself in short order, not just affirming or tolerating the false worship of his foreign wives, but even participating, even facilitating their false worship. And that thing very much displeased God. And so God said, "The kingdom is being taken away from you. Only one tribe will be left to your descendants because I loved your father, but Israel will be taken away from you in your son's days. I won't take away the kingdom in your days, but I will take the kingdom away in your son's days and give the kingdom to your neighbor, to your servant Jeroboam." Jeroboam had been a competent administrator, and so you might have high hopes for him, but those hopes would be dashed. If you had had high hopes in Jeroboam, like Israel did, when they were very displeased with Rehoboam's answer, that is to say, Solomon's son, as Solomon had passed on and they came asking Rehoboam to lighten the tax burden, if you will, on them, Their father had taxed them too highly with all these building projects and maintaining his large staff and his large harem. They wanted a decreased tax burden. Rehoboam took advice from his idiot friends from childhood and gave a harsh answer. And that harsh answer stirred up wrath, just like Proverbs tells us a harsh answer will. And they decided to make Jeroboam king. So their high hopes are in Jeroboam's track record that he's been a good administrator. He's been competent. God gives, it's not just that the people make Jeroboam, but God gives Jeroboam the kingdom and the kingship over Israel. And yet he leads the people away into idolatry. And it says here, verse 14, at that time, Abijah, the son of Jeroboam, fell sick, and Jeroboam said to his wife, arise and disguise yourself, that it be not known that you are the wife of Jeroboam. That's a very interesting thing. This is going to be super secret. Go without anybody knowing. I don't want people to know that you're my wife. Why? Is that because you're embarrassed? Is that because you're still proud and you're not willing to humble yourself and admit that you're in some real trouble with God? Is that what it is? You don't want the people seeing that your wife is being sent. And oh, by the way, why is it your wife? Why are you sending your wife? Why are you not going, Jeroboam? Is it possibly because you wouldn't be able to disguise yourself? Word would get out. Jeroboam went to speak to the prophet. You know, is that what it is? I think so. That's my suspicion. That's speculative. But in any event, Ahijah is the prophet who lives in Shiloh that Jeroboam's wife is going to go and see. Abijah is the son of Jeroboam, but Ahijah is the prophet. Not at all confusing. Yes, it is confusing, actually. But Ahijah is the prophet, and Jeroboam's wife does what her husband tells her to do. She gets up, she goes to Shiloh, comes to the house of Ahijah, but it says that Ahijah was blind because he was old. So his eyes weren't working so good anymore. And yet, God tells Ahijah, the wife of Jeroboam is coming to inquire of you concerning her son, for he is sick. This is what you should say to her, if I can paraphrase. Thus and thus you shall say to her. So God told Ahijah, the prophet, exactly what to say to Jeroboam's wife. Now it says, when she came, she pretended to be another woman. So how long is she going to keep this up, right? She's going to keep this up as a test? I don't think so. I think just because she's putting one foot in front of the other, and Jeroboam had said, go secretly so that nobody will know that you're my wife. Ahijah hears the sound of her feet as she comes in at the door, and he says, come in, wife of Jeroboam. His eyes don't work so well, but his ears work well. This Ahijah was told by God that Jeroboam's wife was coming, and here she is. And you'd have to imagine this is a bit shocking, a bit unnerving for Jeroboam's wife. And yet he asks her right from the jump, why do you pretend to be another? He doesn't give her a chance to answer right away, not in the text. He says, for I am charged with unbearable news for you. I have bad news. In fact, it's really bad news. It's unbearable. You will not be able to bear this news. Go tell Jeroboam, thus says Yahweh, the God of Israel, because I exalted you from among the people and made you leader over my people Israel and tore the kingdom away from the house of David and gave it to you, and yet you have not been like my servant David, who kept my commandments and followed me with all his heart, doing only that which was right in my eyes. But you have done evil above all who were before you and have gone and made for yourself other gods and metal images, provoking me to anger and have cast me behind your back. Therefore, behold, I will bring harm upon the house of Jeroboam and will cut off from Jeroboam every male, both bond and free in Israel, and will burn up the house of Jeroboam as a man burns up dung until it is all gone. This is hard stuff. Not just is your son sick. That's why Jeroboam's wife had come to the prophet to see where's this going. And yet, the man of God who came out of Judah and warned Jeroboam at the altar might have given him a clue. He might have had some idea that this was coming down the pike. And maybe he's wondering, is this just what it is? You know, people get sick. My son might just be sick. Or is this from God? Is this God punishing me? But then the first clue to what you should be doing is, should you be punished? Have you been obedient? Have you been faithful? Not, am I specifically being punished for this particular sin? But is there sin in me that I should repent of? That should be the first question. As a little bit of a detour, but not much, I think of the last week and some change of having thrown my back out and being in pain and not sleeping well, tossing and turning all night long. And I found myself asking my wife, wow, what did I do? Right? Am I under judgment? Is this a time for me to reflect on my life choices? Should I be repenting of something? Should I be asking forgiveness? Man, it's amazing how vulnerable you can get to feeling when you have significant back pain and you're not sleeping well. That is an extraordinarily vulnerable feeling. And so you start thinking, wow, have I been decent to the people who have the opportunity to take care of me right now? Have I been kind to them? You start thinking, as everybody else is asleep and you're tossing and turning and lying awake, you think about, have I been kind to them? Have I been pleasant? Have I been harsh at times? Have I been negligent? Have I been rude? Have I been mean? Or in the case of friends and extended family and acquaintances, you start thinking, have I been attentive enough? Have I inquired enough as to how they're doing? Have I been helpful enough? You start praying to God. You start asking God for insight. You start asking God for healing, for instance. Oh Lord, please heal my back. Oh Lord, please give me sleep. Please grant me rest. Lord, please give me peace. At a certain point too, as your thoughts may run away with you, if you're thinking along very anxious lines, if you're feeling a little bit fearful, if you're feeling very vulnerable, if you're feeling frustrated, you may ask God, why? Right? Why is this happening? What did I do? And I joked with my wife as well. I said, I wonder if maybe I should be reading the book of Job. Was there a conversation between God and the devil? Have you considered my servant Garrett? Yeah, probably not, right? It's more likely that I just made some bad decisions and I'm suffering the consequences. But even so, it's not a waste, right? Even if it was just a coincidence, if you believe in such things, that Abijah, the son of Jeroboam, fell sick. So what? As far as Jeroboam needing to consider his ways, has he been doing what he should have been doing? Has he been doing things that he shouldn't have been doing? Either way, if he hasn't been doing the good that he knew he was supposed to do, that's a sin he should repent of. And if he has been doing the bad things that he shouldn't have been doing, well, then that's a sin that he should repent of. And either way, he should be repenting. You could start there. But is there a willingness to repent, particularly as your sins are not just private sins? They're sins that are public, say, for instance, worshiping false gods at their altars. Is it possible that maybe you should be repenting publicly and that the first clue that you're not willing to do that, you're not going to do that, is you're sending your wife? You're not even going yourself? Jeroboam. Wow. Not a good look. Not a good reality. This is not a good dynamic. Poor woman. Why isn't Jeroboam going? Well, the answer is because of pride, it seems. And yet, here's the answer from the prophet, the old prophet Ahijah at Shiloh. You have done evil above all who were before you, and have gone and made for yourself other gods and metal images, provoking me to anger, and have cast me behind your back. Therefore, behold, I will bring harm. Now, what's so interesting, right? What's so interesting is there was going to be a big fight initially, right when Rehoboam was rejected by Israel and they decided to make Jeroboam king. There was going to be a big fight. Rehoboam fled in his chariot to get back to Jerusalem, and he was going to muster this large force of the men of Judah and the men of Benjamin, because apparently the men of Benjamin are a little bit fickle. They go back and forth, whichever way the wind blows. Oh, are we for Israel and Jeroboam now? Oh, look, the wind's blowing the other way. I guess we're for Judah and Rehoboam now. God said, don't. Don't go fight against your relatives. This thing is from me. This division is from me. And yet it said a little later that there was constant war between Rehoboam and Jeroboam, between Judah and Israel. So even though they didn't right then, they listened right then, in due time, they stopped listening and they decided to fight it out. God could use that here. And it could just be natural circumstances. And yet the word from the prophet to the wife of Jeroboam, for Jeroboam to know, is that this is from me. I will do this thing to you and your household. Not just I'm going to burn up your house, but I'm going to burn it like so much dung. I'm going to burn it, and even the burning of it is going to be very noxious and gross and disgusting. But this is stark stuff. It says Jeroboam did more evil than anybody who came before him. And so the consequence is going to be that all the males of his house will be cut off. Anyone belonging to Jeroboam who dies in the city, the dogs shall eat. Wow, that's quite a lot of contempt. That's quite a disgrace. They won't even get a proper burial. The dogs are going to eat them. That's what it says. And that's from God. Anyone who dies in the open country, the birds of the heavens shall eat. For Yahweh has spoken it. Stark, brutal. But lest you think that this is unfair, and you think, wow, that's really severe and that's really harsh. Should I feel sorry for Jeroboam? Well, let me ask this. Do we perhaps underestimate how serious idolatry is? Do we perhaps underestimate how big of a deal it is that not just a people, but the ruler over a people would lead his nation in the worship of other gods? With no excuse, no excuse of pleading ignorance. Oh, I didn't know. No, you knew. In fact, the way that you became king in the first place was because Solomon did a very similar thing. Now, he just kind of slid into it over time, but you have surpassed his sin and the sin of everybody else who came before you. You know, the people of Israel, when they were first without Moses for 40 days and nights, as Moses was up on the mountain getting the law of God written on two tablets of stone by the finger of God, getting the Ten Commandments, they thought to themselves, talked amongst themselves at a certain point, and they said, he's not coming back. Perhaps God has killed him. Aaron, up, make us a god. They had one golden calf. Jeroboam made two, almost like he was intentionally trying to go above and beyond. Hey, it didn't work the last time. Well, let's try two this time. This is the consequence. Don't feel sorry for Jeroboam as much as you are sobered by how serious this is. If true worship brings blessings and false worship brings judgment, recognize that Jeroboam leading the whole nation of Israel in this means that he has done a tremendous amount of harm. He's brought a tremendous amount of cursing on the people who look to him for leadership. This being such an incredibly severe, but really not too severe, not excessively severe, but far more severe than we would judge appropriate judgment against Jeroboam and against his household. Maybe that's not a sign that God was being too harsh. Maybe it's a sign that we don't correctly think about, rightly understand, appreciate the gravity of the situation. Just a thought going on down here, though. It says, Jeroboam's wife arose and departed. She was told by Ahijah, the moment you step foot back into the city, your child shall die. Your child will be the only one who gets to go to the grave because I have found something in your child that I like and I love. The rest of your family? No, this will be the judgment. Verse 14, moreover, Yahweh will raise up for himself a king over Israel who shall cut off the house of Jeroboam today. And henceforth, Yahweh will strike Israel as a reed is shaken in the water and root up Israel out of this good land that he gave to their fathers and scatter them beyond the Euphrates because they have made their Asherim, provoking Yahweh to anger. And he will give Israel up because of the sins of Jeroboam, which he sinned and made Israel to sin. So then we see that this is not just Jeroboam. It's not just whatever he does privately. That's his private business. And we separate out church and state like so because he didn't. He didn't, and that's not the way that it works. Oh, Jeroboam can worship these false gods? Well, I want to be on good terms with the king. I want to have favor with him. I want to do what he does and be like him so that I can be close to him so that I get some of these benefits. How do you find favor with Yahweh God? You be like Yahweh God. be an imitator of God. How do you find favor with a king? You be like that king. Imitation is the sincerest form of flattery. All Israel imitates Jeroboam in the worship of these false gods. And so it's not just Jeroboam, it's also Israel, which will lose this good land. They will be scattered. And we know, in hindsight, retrospectively, we know that's what happened. They were scattered. Verse 17, then Jeroboam's wife arose and departed and came to Tirzah, and as she came to the threshold of the house, the child died, and all Israel buried him and mourned for him according to the word of Yahweh. Verse 19, now the rest of the acts of Jeroboam, how he warred and how he reigned, behold, they are written in the book of Chronicles of the kings of Israel. And the time that Jeroboam reigned was 22 years, and he slept with his fathers, and Nadab his son reigned in his place. Now, the very last of this chapter switches back to Rehoboam, son of Solomon, grandson of David. It says, now Rehoboam, the son of Solomon, reigned in Judah. He was 41 years old when he began to reign, and he reigned 17 years in Jerusalem, the city that Yahweh had chosen out of all the tribes of Israel to put his name there. His mother's name was Naamah, the Ammonite. And oh, by the way, the Ammonites were one of the people groups that they weren't supposed to intermarry with. Remember? 1 Kings 11, verse 1. Moabite, Ammonite, Edomite, Sidonian, and Hittite women. Verse 2, from the nations concerning which Yahweh had said to the people of Israel, you shall not enter into marriage with them, neither shall they with you, for surely they will turn away your heart after their gods. Rehoboam is not just the son of Solomon, he's also the son of an Ammonite woman. That's a problem. That's part of the problem. Verse 22, and Judah did what was evil in the sight of Yahweh, and they provoked him to jealousy with their sins that they committed, more than all that their fathers had done. For they also built for themselves high places and pillars and asherim on every high hill and under every green tree, and there were also male cult prostitutes in the land. They did according to all the abominations of the nations that Yahweh had driven out before the people of Israel. What happens next is, not for the last time, not for the first time, God raising up a foreign ruler, a foreign people, to judge his people, to punish his people for their faithlessness and their sin. In the fifth year, so this is not very far in, there's a dozen more years to his reign after this, but this is the fifth year of King Rehoboam's reign. Shishak, king of Egypt, comes up against Jerusalem, and he takes away the treasures of the house of Yahweh and the treasures of the king's house. He takes away everything, it says. He takes away the shields of gold that Solomon had made that were so impressive, just like wealth can flow into a nation from the surrounding nations. Also, wealth can be extracted from a nation. You forget yourself, and they may come and collect and take more than what they had put into you in the first place. You may lose everything that you got from them, and then some. That's what happens here. King Rehoboam, verse 27, made in their place, that is the place of the shields of gold, shields of bronze, which, oh, by the way, are not as impressive. They're not as valuable because everything's been taken away from you. It's a sign of the times. You've gone backwards from a golden age to, I guess, a bronze age. Rehoboam committed them to the hands of the officers of the guard who kept the door of the king's house, and as often as the king went into the house of Yahweh, the guard carried them and brought them back to the guard room. Now the rest of the acts of Rehoboam and all that he did, are they not written in the book of the Chronicles of the kings of Judah? Verse 30 here, there was war between Rehoboam and Jeroboam continually, and Rehoboam slept with his fathers and was buried with his fathers in the city of David. If you forgot, here we see his mother referenced again. His mother's name was Naamah the Ammonite. And Abijam, his son, reigned in his place. And it's so curious what parallel tracks Rehoboam and Jeroboam are on. Their names are very similar. The names of their sons are very similar. You've got Abijah, son of Jeroboam, and you have Abijam, son of Rehoboam. Very curious. Also, the way that Judah and Israel relate to the foreign gods, the gods of the foreign nations that they weren't supposed to worship, that God originally drove out the peoples of Canaan because they worshiped them. Yeah, those gods, both Israel and Judah, though separate, will worship those gods and be judged for it and be punished for it. Not to give anything away, but the rest of the Old Testament is a whole lot of back and forth, up and down, like a sine wave. People of Israel worshiping those gods, and then every now and then returning to faithful obedience to, reverence of Yahweh God. But they're parallel tracks. They're separate tracks now, Israel and Judah, but they're very parallel and they resemble one another quite a lot. And yet I want to mention just briefly, in this section here, you see cult prostitutes, and not just cult prostitutes, but male cult prostitutes. And so we see that this isn't just some abstract, ritualistic thought exercise where it's a tradition that's different than the tradition of worshiping Yahweh God. But all religions are basically the same. Some people will talk like that, think like that. No, some religions have cult prostitutes. Some religions have male cult prostitutes because they're especially degenerate. Judgment is brought by means of the natural consequences, but also you have God promising special intervention that he himself will sweep away Israel and Judah for their idolatry. As we continue, as we progress, we'll find he does use foreign nations. He does use characters like Shishak, king of Egypt, to execute justice and judgment and punishment on his people, Israel, and on his people, Judah. And we might feel sorry for the people of Israel and the people of Judah. We might mourn for them, but we should also recognize that this is not excessively severe. It's not unjust of God. It's not unfair. It's just that we don't appreciate, like we should, the gravity of these sins. And that is to say, we probably should take a closer look at whether we've repented like we should of the sins that we commit, the sins of the people around us, the sins of our nation. But that's enough of 1 Kings chapter 14 for this episode, it being the first episode of the new year. I want to transition into something a little lighter after a fashion. I want to talk about the books that I read last year and what my goal is for this coming year, as far as reading goes. So first up, before going into a reading of what were all the books, what were all the titles that I read in 2023, I would say, if you have not set up an account on goodreads.com yet, you should. You should set up an account. And if you have not been much of a reader, this is a great little way to set a goal for yourself in the new year to be reading more. And it's a great way to find new books to read. It's a great way to figure out which books you think you might like to read, you actually want to read next, in part because you can see reviews from not just, you know, people who are writing for some big magazine. You accidentally come across their review of a book, not just people who write for some newspaper and, okay, great, you know, this is a New York Times bestseller, and so they're going to give a little blurb about it. Not just the publisher summary, although you can get that on Goodreads as well, but you can see reviews from anybody and everybody who's read that book, and they want to tell you about it. And they'll give a 5-star rating. They'll say, I, you know, liked it. I really enjoyed it. It was great. It was fantastic. I loved it. You know, that sort of a thing. But then they'll also give their reasons why. And sometimes the reasons why somebody liked a book or didn't like a book, both and, can be helpful. You'll say, I now want to read this book, or, okay, that's not so interesting. And so it increases the likelihood you're going to get titles that you are happy with and that you stick to and you see through to completion. And even when it comes to some material being denser or more complicated, or you're just trying to make sense of it, what a book club would do, Goodreads can do some of that, wherein maybe you get stuck on a certain concept or you're just thrown for a loop and you're like, what is this? Depending on the reviewer, depending on the book, you'll find other people drawing out what they saw in the book that they liked. And you can filter based on, you know, how many stars they gave a book. If you're like, I just really can't even get into this, I don't get what the appeal is, you could sort the reviews by who all gave it 5 stars. And if you see a whole lot of superficiality and they're just like, oh, I loved it, you know, that's all they say, every now and then you'll get one who is really substantive and they go into the details and they like a deep dive. And so here you go, you know, here's your deep dive. So Goodreads, it's a great little website for figuring out books to read, keeping track of books you've read. Also, for the last several years, I've been using it to set a challenge and set a goal for myself. And then as I mark books as, you know, currently reading, or I have read this book, if I put the date on there, it will tally up whether I am close to, whether I'm on track to meet my reading challenge goal for the year. This last year and the year before, I set a goal of reading one book per week. 52 weeks in a year, I wanted to read at least 52 books. This last year, I read 80. So 2023, my best year ever as far as reading books is concerned, I read 80 books. And before I get into some stats that I find interesting that Goodreads helps me to, I guess, have access to, I wouldn't have the time to compile these kinds of stats just on my own. Before I get into some of those stats for my reading, which you also could have available to you if you get a Goodreads account and start using it as it's supposed to be used, as it can be used, I'm just going to read for you the titles, because there being this many, I reviewed each one of these or made reference throughout the year. You can go back and you can listen to my episodes where I review these or I talk about them. If you haven't yet, just listen to my podcast episodes from 2023. But I'll just read the titles for now. And that in its own way can be interesting to see what I was reading one thing after another for 2023. First up, the first book I finished last year was Silas Marner by George Eliot, who was a woman, by the way. George Eliot, that was a pseudonym back when women were not expected to get published. So she went by George Eliot. Silas Marner, a great little title. Thanks to Lauren for recommending that I read it. A Lady's Life in the Rocky Mountains by Isabella L. Bird. Very interesting too. Lots in there about Colorado. An interesting travel journal recommended to me by my cousin, Micah Hirschberger. I highly recommend it if you find travel journals interesting. Generally, I highly recommend it if you find American history in the 19th century interesting. I highly recommend it if you live in the Rocky Mountains area. She gives really detailed accounts as an English woman traveling not just through the Rocky Mountains region, but at other times in her life. Apparently, she traveled to other important, meaningful places in the world and journaled about it and published her journals. This one just happens to be where she is wanting to get to Estes Park, for instance. She's wanting to see the Rocky Mountains. And so she comes overland and does just that. She's traveling sometimes all by herself, just her and her horse. And other times she finds companions. She makes friends along the way and spends time with them and works and hears stories, writes down their stories. It's a really, really good book. Really, really interesting. Very, very interesting snapshot into 1800s Colorado. But next up was It's Good to Be a Man by Non Tennant and Michael Foster. After that, I reread Tartuffe by Molière, then The Great Reset by Mark Morano. I read The Communist Manifesto by Karl Marx, A Christian Manifesto by Francis Schaeffer, Technopoly by Neil Postman, Just Do Something by Kevin DeYoung, Chosen by God, written by R.C. Sproul, Generations by William Strauss and Neil Howe, Scipio Africanus, Greater Than Napoleon by B.H. Liddell Hart, Karl Marx and the Satanic Roots of Communism by Richard Wurmbrand, The Peacemaker by William Inbeden, that one about Ronald Reagan in the White House and the world, The Call of the Wild by Jack London, The Oregon Trail by Francis Parkman, another contemporary account, someone writing down what they saw, who they interacted with as they're out west in the 1800s. Dominion by Tom Holland, a really excellent read. Really, really fantastic. If you've been thinking about reading it and you haven't yet, do read Dominion. Next up, J.R.R. Tolkien's The Adventures of Tom Bombadil, another work by Neil Postman, co-written with Steve Powers, titled How to Watch TV News. The Man Behind the Curtain by Matt Palumbo. then The Moral Case for Fossil Fuels by Alex Epstein, How to Win an Argument by Marcus Tullius Cicero, Frederick Douglass by Frederick Douglass, his autobiography, Leo Loudon's How to Talk to Anyone, Oz Guinness's Fool's Talk, then To Kill a Mockingbird by Harper Lee, The Coming of Neo-Feudalism by Joel Kotkin, Mythos by Stephen Fry, The Modern Scholars, Hebrews, Greeks, and Romans by Timothy B. Schutt, Weapons of Mass Instruction by John Taylor Gatto, another Neil Postman work, The Disappearance of Childhood, Quiet by Susan Cain, Ian Fleming's first James Bond novel, Casino Royale, Babylon by Paul Krukowiak, I think I'm saying that name correctly, Krukowiak, I'll just call him Paul. Babylon. I read the book Babylon by a guy named Paul. Robin Sharma's The 5 a.m. Club, which I hated, and I thought it was just superficial, motivational speaker trash. Brainwashed by Ben Shapiro, which was all right. Scotland, A History from Earliest Times by Alistair Moffat. Michael Crichton's The Andromeda Strain. The Fighting Bunch by Chris DeRose. That one was fascinating. Really, really fascinating. The Politically Incorrect Guide to the Great Depression by Robert P. Murphy. The Law by Frederick Bastiat. Also another really, really good read. I'm really glad I read that one this year. This past year, I suppose I should say. Compassion versus Guilt and Other Essays by Thomas Sowell. The Three Musketeers by Alexandre Dumas. The Conservative Mind from Burke to Eliot by Russell Kirk. The Great Divorce by C.S. Lewis. The Housing Boom and Bust by Thomas Sowell. The Abolition of Man by C.S. Lewis. Fahrenheit 451 by Ray Bradbury. Almost combined his two names there. It's actually Ray Bradbury. Recovering the Lost Tools of Learning, like how to read and speak correctly. Recovering the Lost Tools of Learning by Douglas Wilson. I read that one as well. The Letter to the American Church by Eric Metaxas. Meditations by Marcus Aurelius. How Do You Kill 11 Million People by Andy Andrews. The Toxic War on Masculinity by Nancy R. Piercy, which I found interesting at parts, and other times I was very frustrated by that book. And Nancy R. Piercy and Mainstream American Evangelicalism. What to Expect When No One's Expecting by Jonathan V. Last. The Politically Incorrect Guide to Women, Sex, and Feminism by Carrie L. Lucas. Wayne Grudem's Politics According to the Bible. Thank you to Isaiah Arachios for recommending that one. The Old Man and the Sea by Ernest Hemingway. Thank you again to my wife, Lauren, for recommending that one. Men and Marriage by George Gilder. That one was much better. I liked that one much better than The Toxic War on Masculinity. A few caveats still, but it was a good book. Plutarch's Lives, I finally finished by who else but Plutarch. The Life of Samuel Johnson by James Boswell, I also finally finished, and it was delightful. And I was very sad at the end of it to bid adieu to Samuel Johnson. Heart of Darkness by Joseph Conrad. The Weapon Wizards by Yakov Katz. The Legend of Sleepy Hollow by Washington Irving, which is also really, really great. A short read. I think I'm going to try and fit in more of such short classic reads this coming year. The Righteous Mind by Jonathan Haidt, which was not my favorite. Patrick J. Deneen's Why Liberalism Failed. Then all five titles in Stephen Lawhead's Pendragon Cycle, Taliesin, Merlin, Arthur, Pendragon, and Grail, which I enjoyed immensely. That was the best fantasy novel series I've read in a long, long time, quite probably since reading Lord of the Rings, honestly. I liked it better than Wheel of Time, truth be told. George Gilder's Life After Television, The Coming Transformation of Media and American Life, Just Thinking About the State by Daryl Harrison and Virgil Walker, The Unsettling of America by Wendell Berry, subtitle Culture and Agriculture, The Scottish Clearances by T.M. Devine, The Anglo-Saxons by Mark Morris, The Dark Tower by C.S. Lewis, The Dark Tower and Other Stories. Also another Modern Scholar entry, A History of the English Language, featuring Professor Drought. Between Heaven and Hell, A Dialogue Somewhere Beyond Death with John F. Kennedy, C.S. Lewis, and Aldous Huxley by Peter Kreeft. It was all right. It was okay. Interesting. Not my favorite, but I can see why some people really enjoy that one. The Oresteia, Agamemnon, the Libation Bearers, and the Eumenides by Aeschylus. That one I enjoyed. That was a really good rendition that I had just hanging out in my Audible library. I think I picked it up for Lauren because the kids were going through it for school. And then lastly, another recommendation from my wife, Lauren, as so many were coming from school reading lists for our kids, Farmer Giles of Ham by J.R.R. Tolkien. Really delightful. Just a really delightful read. Not set in the Lord of the Rings universe, but just kind of a more generic fantasy, pseudo-historical type, you know, maybe prior to the days of King Arthur, sort of a character here. But it's fun, right? It's fun and it's witty and it's whimsical in a children's book sort of a way, but very appreciable. You don't have to be a child to read fairy tales like Farmer Giles of Ham. In fact, you might enjoy them all the more if you're not. And what's great is, in the older sense of a title like this being mature for mature audiences, it is. In an older sense, now we say for mature audiences only. And what we mean is that there's a whole lot of filth and there's a whole lot of depravity being shown here. And the kids shouldn't see that depravity, but the adults want to. In the case of Farmer Giles of Ham by J.R.R. Tolkien, I would say you're going to enjoy this all the more if you're more mature. Children would enjoy this book, no doubt about it, but you don't have to be a child in order to enjoy Farmer Giles of Ham. But that is to say, I read 80 books in 2023. I had a goal set for myself of 52, one for every week of the year, but I read 80. And what's interesting is I just discovered this. I don't know how long it's been on Goodreads. You can actually pull up your stats and you can see year over year how many books you've read. And also you can pull up, you know, what those books were. So just like I can read through, like I just did, the 2023 Reading Challenge book list, I can also pull up what it was in 2022 and 2021 and 2020. But then they also have some tabs where you can pull up graphs. And what I noticed, and I didn't notice this, it was kind of lost on me, but it's fun that I found it, or it found me. In 2020, I read 36 books. In 2021, I read 53. So I went up by, what is that, 17 titles? In 2022, I read 62 books. That is to say, I read 9 more books than I had in 2021. In 2023, I read 80 books, which is to say that I went up 18 titles. And so it seems to me as though, as I'm picking up pace, maybe I'm having an easier time with work, the type of work that I was doing in 2022 and in 2023 was more conducive to being able to listen to audiobooks while I work. I'm going to strike while the iron's hot, and I'm going to plan to read even more books in 2024 than I did in 2023. I'm going to shoot for 100. Why not? Right? I read 80 books this last year. Why not go for 100 and see? Because some people do. Some people read 100 books a year. Now, they're not probably reading big, long works like The Life of Samuel Johnson and Plutarch's Lives. Those were extraordinarily long books. But that's okay. Maybe I need to really deep dive into lists of classics that are shorter that I either have never read or I read them so long ago that it would be basically like reading them for the first time again if I reread them in 2024. So that's going to be my goal. If you have some recommendations for classic novels, classic essays, you know, the things in book form that would properly be classified as books on Goodreads, send them my way. Recommend them to me. Go get an account on Goodreads and recommend those books to me. Do me a favor. That'll be really great. Also, feel free to follow me on Goodreads because you'll be able to see as I add titles what I'm reading, and if I leave a review here and there now and again, you'll be able to see those. But then back to my book's stats. I found some other things interesting here. So Goodreads will keep track of how many pages are in a book. And that's easy enough to do. book by book, because usually the publisher will give that information as they're trying to market the book online. You know, how long is this book is a big question that people ask. If you're listening on audio, you're looking at, okay, how many hours is it? If you're reading a print book, knowing how many pages there are gives you some idea how long it's going to take for you to read this book. How committed are you to the subject? Maybe one factor. Also, is a book too short for how interested you are? Yeah, maybe another factor. If I really want to deep dive into the history of England from the year 400 to 1066, maybe I don't want a two-hour book. Maybe I don't want a 90-page book in print. Maybe I want one that's going to be, 17, 18 hours long on Audible, and it's going to be, 300 some pages in a physical copy. Well, in any event, it's interesting for me to look at not just the number of titles in the My Books stats area on Goodreads, but also to see how many pages I read per year. Like I said, in 2020, I read 36 books. That amounted to 12,833 pages. In 2021, I went up to 20,726 pages equivalent. Now, most of these were audiobooks. Bear that in mind. But still, 20,726 pages equivalent, I wouldn't have been able to read if I was confined to reading physical print books. And so I'm very glad I was able to listen to that many pages worth. 2022, I went down just a little bit. I actually had more titles, but apparently they were, on average, shorter titles. I went down to 19,657 pages equivalent. In 2023, I went up again to a new personal best for me, 23,759. Not a tremendous amount more in the way of pages, but then that is to say I've got some longer books that I finished in 2023, and I listened to a significant number of shorter books. I think I want to listen to more and more shorter books in the coming year. And so it'll be interesting to see if I do get 100 books read this coming year, what will my page count be? Will my page count be as good or better? Will I actually be getting more content and more wisdom, more insight, more knowledge in the way of reading more books, but shorter books? We'll see. Also, a really fascinating little graph here. There's a publication year, and I love this. I geek out about this being in visual form, because I would try to do something like this on my own, and it would just take me forever, but they're automatically doing it, so why not avail yourself? Publication year charts the year that the book was published in, or it's thought to have been originally published in, and also what month and what year you marked having read it. And so it's like a scatter chart. And I see a whole lot, right? A whole lot is up in the, 2000s, 2010s. Some, not often, but some are, 2020s. Most are in the 2000s or the 2010s, or most are in the 20th century, 1900s, somewhere in there. But I have a good amount that were published actually in the 1800s. I have some that were published in the 1700s. And then every now and then, I see titles that dip down into the 1600s or that dip down into the 1500s. Not a whole lot of 1500s, just a couple of titles. The Fairy Queen, which I read back in 2020, and The Bondage of the Will by Martin Luther back in October of 2021. But every now and then, I dip way older, way farther down in the published in chart here. The City of God, 426, is when that's thought to have been published by Augustine. Eusebius's The Church History, thought to have been published in 324. I read both of those titles in 2021. The Complete Histories of Polybius, I read in August of 2022. That one is thought to have been published in 170 BC. Actually, 170 BC. Then also this last year, I read Meditations by Marcus Aurelius. 180 AD is when that was published. Also Parallel Lives, Plutarch's Lives, published around about 100 AD. And then the last old ancient from antiquity title that I have is the Oresteia by Aeschylus. And that one is thought to have been published in 458 BC. So very, very old. Except the Bible, these are the oldest books I've ever read. And it's neat to see them charted like this. And to see, okay, yeah, I've read some old books, but how about recently, right? Recently, have I been favoring more newer contemporary authors, or is it all old stuff, right? Maybe I talk more about the material that was written and published in the 1800s or the 1700s, but am I just not reading good enough books that are more recent than that? You know, some interesting things to think about if you start using Goodreads and start availing yourself of that utility there. Publication year under stats, under my books, that's how you find it. And I think it's a really neat little feature. Now that said, I have very little time, almost no time left. And so we're going to actually wrap up this episode here in just a minute. But I wanted to leave you with a thought as we've been talking about books that I read in 2023 and my hope, my plan to read even more books in 2024. There's basically two categories of content, other than reading scripture and thoughts on the reading. There's two kinds of content that feature prominently in my podcast. One, books, right? What have I been reading? And what did I learn? And how do I think this can be useful and beneficial? But then useful and beneficial for what? That brings us to our second category of content on this podcast, which is current events. Understanding what's going on. What is happening in the news cycle? What's happening in our country? What's happening in my area? How do I understand it rightly so that I can relate to it in a way that is discerning, in a way that is going to be beneficial and honorable? You know, one analogy you might make is the study of meteorology. And I've got right now up on my screen AccuWeather, which is my go-to. I like their app. I like their website. But I've got Greeley Weather, their daily tab, open on my browser. And it's self-evident how useful this is. What are we going to do on Wednesday? What are we going to do on Saturday? Well, I don't know. Let's check the weather, right? Were we thinking about doing something outside? Were we thinking about going to the zoo? Were we thinking about going for a hike? Let's see what the temperatures are supposed to be that day. Let's see what the cloud cover is going to be. Is it going to be sunny? Is it going to be rainy? Is it going to be snowy? How are the roads going to be? Do we want to take a trip? Do we want to take a drive? If there may be a snowstorm that day, we may have icy road conditions, or do we want to postpone, or do we want to go earlier rather than later? All of these things, so self-evidently helpful about looking at the forecast. But then what goes into the forecast is an understanding of how previous weather patterns develop over time. You know, here we see a cold front, there we see a warm front, here we see pressure drop, here we see humidity changes, here we see wind speed, and we see these things likely to collide in this area in so many days. We see the conditions that are favorable to this sort of a weather pattern shaping up, and we're not 100% sure, right? They'll give percentage to their predictions here. But we're not 100% sure, but we think there's a possibility we'll have some precipitation Friday, right? There's a 9% chance. Well, where does that 9% come from? It comes from having considered the weather as it was before. You know, what was the weather doing a year ago at this time, 10 years ago at this time, a century ago at this time? As we have more data, so long as our way of evaluating and assessing the data is sound and we actually want to put it to a good purpose, we're going to benefit. We'll benefit. We'll have more accurate weather models, and we'll have better forecasts, as in more accurate forecasts to give us a better idea of what to expect. And then we plan around that. Now, what you wouldn't say, and I've never heard anybody say this, so I assume you wouldn't say it, is, well, because I'm not a meteorologist, I don't need some weather app on my phone. Because I'm not a meteorologist, I don't need AccuWeather on my computer. I don't need a subscription to the Weather Channel on my TV. I don't need that. I'm not a meteorologist. You would never say that, right? You would never say that. It's precisely because some people are these experts or they have studied it out. It's precisely because it is your business or it does pertain to your business and you do need to make decisions relative to the weather, or the weather is going to affect the outcome of your plans. It's going to affect your execution of your plans. It's because of all of that that you're glad that there are meteorologists, and it's also why they have a job. They have a job because people will support the work that they're doing financially, in part because everybody's looking at this weather app, and so the website's able to sell advertising. Or maybe they sell access to a blog. While I'm here checking what the weather is going to be in Greeley, you're going to give me top stories. Well, why do I need top stories? Because sometimes the weather is anecdotal. And sometimes it's not just what temperature is it going to be at the warmest and at the coolest, and how fast is the wind going to be blowing, and from what direction, and what's the likelihood of precipitation. It's not just that. It's also, here's a story about somebody who survived a tornado. Oh, interesting. Well, while I'm thinking about, you know, the weather, why don't I maybe get some ideas for what if we were caught in a flash flood? What if there was a wildfire because it's especially dry and we needed to get out? You know, all that is analogous to reading good books by people who had insight, understanding, experience, you know, people who had knowledge of the facts of a situation, or they had firsthand involvement in a situation, and they can at least tell how they saw it or how they felt about it, or they have wisdom, right? They have wisdom to share. Yeah, lots of people have written about this, but this person here, they understand the situation, whether secondhand from studying lots and lots of material, lots of evidence related to it, or because they went through it, they lived through it. They know something we don't. When you read good books, and it's not necessarily just nonfiction, right? This can also find its way, and I think it does find its way, especially in more censorious times when people are less tolerant of truth-telling that is direct. You know, this can also apply to fiction as well, where ideas and insights and analysis work their way into made-up stories, fairy tales, for instance. But understanding what has happened, if you're paying attention and if you're honest and if you're figuring out not just what the facts are, but how to make sense of those facts in connection to one another, that can help you to make plans for your individual and personal life in a more successful way. If you know that there's going to be a big storm coming up, metaphorically, then maybe you plan to try and make your trip before that storm rolls in, or you wait until after the storm has passed. For instance, for example, if you know that there's a big storm coming politically or socially or culturally, maybe you'd still go anyways. Maybe you still go out and you still do what you were planning to do, but you're going to do it with a little bit more of a prepared mind. You may be thinking about scenarios. You may be dressing differently. You may make sure that you've got an umbrella. You may make sure that you've got some food in the vehicle just in case you get stuck. You know, hey, if I got stuck because of the snow, I would want to have something to eat to keep my body heat up. For instance, I would want to make sure I had blankets. I would want to make sure I had fill in the blank. All that is to say, I would encourage you all, if you're not reading, start reading. And start small. Start with a manageable goal, 10 books a year, 12 books a year, maybe one book a month. And pick books that there's a high probability you will actually finish them. And you can come up with something that would be a benefit to you and to other people. You can love God better. You can love your neighbor as yourself better if you read this book, even if it's, hey, I read this book and I now have some ideas of how not to talk, how not to relate to people. That can be sometimes as valid and as helpful as, oh, hey, that was really great. I'm gonna keep that. I'm gonna write that quote down for a rainy day, so to speak. If you haven't started, do start. Go check out Goodreads. I've found it to be very useful. I've got plenty of friends on there who would say the same. It seems. Connect with me on there, send me a friend request, or follow me on there. I'll follow you back. I'll be interested to see what you're reading as well, and we can encourage each other in that way. But that's all the time I've got for this episode. Speaking of knowing what time it is and what's coming up, I got to get to work. As always, thank you for listening. Until next time, God bless.
You've been listening to The Garrett Ashley Mullet Show on Anchor FM. For more content like what you just heard, subscribe to this podcast on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, or Spotify. Also, check out thegarrettashleymulletshow.com to subscribe to email alerts when new episodes are published. As always, you can reach me with any comments, questions, complaints, objections, or insights at garrettashleymullet@protonmail.com.